and welcome to the Employee Safety Podcast from Alert Media, where you'll hear advice from experienced safety leaders on how to protect your people and business. I'm Peter Steinfeld. April is Workplace Violence Prevention Awareness Month, so I wanted to ask an expert how organizations can up-level their workplace violence prevention programs and adapt to stay resilient in the future. I'm excited to welcome Brian Strauser, an expert in corporate security, intelligence, business continuity, and crisis management for over 20 years. These days, he helps organizations develop all kinds of resiliency programs in his consultancy, BrightPath. Let's listen in. Hey, Brian, thanks so much for being here today.
Hey, Peter, thank you for having me.
All right, well, let's go ahead and jump into it. For starters, what's the most important element of a successful workplace violence prevention program that any organization out there needs, regardless of their size?
I mean, I think that there's really two important things. One is a commitment in the organization from the top management, the leaders of the company, about having a violence-free workplace and being committed to that and demonstrating that commitment. And the second is really having a centralized place where everyone understands where to report threats or actual incidents of workplace violence.
Why is that buy-in so important? I mean, it seems obvious, but maybe if you could elaborate on that a bit.
Well, I think it's like any other cultural element in an organization. Everyone is going to look to the actions and the comments, the communication that they see from their senior leaders about what is important. And they need to model that behavior by establishing that desire to have a violence-free workplace. And they need to model that with actions by supporting the program and make sure it has appropriate resources and actions behind it.
Yeah, otherwise people just won't trust it. They'll say, Oh, they're just saying this. And then if I really see something and I say something, I'll get fired. And people can't feel that way. Like, this is extremely serious and people have to feel 100% comfortable talking about it, reporting it, and not feel like they'll be threatened for their job if they say something.
And the first time that they see a senior leader excuse some kind of threatening behavior because, you know, it's another senior leader or it's someone who the organization maybe has invested a lot in, they view as high potential, but they're abusive in their actions or they engage in workplace violence or threats of workplace violence. The first time they see that excuse, then the whole program will not have the credibility within the organization that it needs to.
You're only as strong as your weakest link, right?
That's right.
Well, what are some of the key things that you look for when you're working with organizations to improve their workplace violence programs?
Well, one is to make sure that they've established the right processes in the organization. So, you know, we talked about having a centralized place for these kind of threats and incidents to be reported. Then it's the operational processes of making sure once that is reported that the right follow-ups are taken. Is that threat being evaluated? Is that incident being responded to? Are the right safety and security measures being put into place to make sure that the workplace remains safe and that that inappropriate behavior, if that is what has happened, has been properly investigated and dealt with? But it also is some basic things like, has the team been properly trained? So for leaders of teams, for managers and, you know, their managers and directors and vice presidents and such, they need to understand how to manage a threat of workplace violence and how to make sure those get escalated. For the average everyday employee, it's understanding what behavior is acceptable and not acceptable and how to report that, regardless of who might be engaging in that behavior.
Do you have any recommendations on how to report? Because some people say it should be anonymous. Some people say there should be a name attached to it. Like, there's so much to unpack in that item alone. What are your thoughts there?
Well, I think you need to provide multiple methods that go to a centralized place. There is a place for anonymous reporting as long as you're able to gather the right facts that can lead to an investigation. And in some states and some countries, that anonymous reporting is required by law to be able to happen. But it's often hard to investigate these things without knowing details. And that's why I think providing a way where you're making it clear to the team that they can safely and confidentially report the facts of what has happened, what they perceive as that threat and the behaviors that they've witnessed, so that it can be properly investigated. And you have to create that safe space, so to speak, for them to report that in a confidential way and ensure it will be followed up on.
And let's say I'm someone who has observed something that's disturbing and I want to report it. What do I do? Clearly, it's going to be different by organization and the processes and the culture, but let's say there's nothing in place, how should you bring that forward in a professional way to your manager or someone above them?
Yeah, if there's nothing in place, then I think you need to report that to your leader. Or if the leader is the one doing this, then you need to go above them or go to human resources or a internal third party that is not directly involved in the situation. Ideally, you want companies to have a hotline of some type or a centralized reporting mechanism that no matter whether that's reported to a leader or it's reported to HR or to another or security, for example, it gets routed to a central place to be monitored and investigated and escalated appropriately.
And something else you mentioned is the importance of having management be trained on how to deal with this kind of stuff. What are some thoughts there that when you consult with people to say, hey, these are the top three things you should focus on with your managers to get them used to handling these things?
So one is making sure that managers understand the importance of dealing with this, that it is a serious issue to understand, to take seriously, to confront and move through whatever processes are put into place. The second is to help them understand what is a threat. I think a lot of managers will, particularly in some industries where a little more rough and tumble, so to speak, managers won't take some of these threatening comments seriously because they just think it's part of the environment, it's part of the industry that we're working in. So we have to train them on what does that unacceptable and inappropriate behavior look like. The third is that they have to be trained on whatever the processes are for the organization. What is their role in leading the team and dealing with those behaviors, but also what's their role in escalating this and making sure that it's followed up on? They'll have an obligation to make sure this is escalated to whatever processes the company has put into place, but they have to be trained on what those obligations are.
Yeah, it's really important. I know just in my career, I've had people come to me and say, hey, this happened. And I took it seriously, even though it turned out after an investigation to really be nothing. But then you establish trust all the way up and down the chain because the people now feel that, look, I know that turned out to be nothing, but I'm really happy you listened to me. You took it seriously. You did an investigation. Now they trust the process. And the next time something happens where it's real, wow, it's really going to make a big difference.
And employees notice all of this from a trust standpoint, right? They know when their leaders are not following the processes that have been outlined. They know when leaders are not making the right decisions. And they're looking for that, particularly in today's job market where they have options that they may not have had 2 or 3, 4, 5 years ago for mobility and finding opportunities in other organizations.
I mean, I say it on the show all the time, but focusing on safety is a competitive advantage. In our employee safety report that we run every year where we interview employees out there, like, what do you think of your employer and what they're doing to protect you? It's very enlightening. And people will vote with their feet if they don't feel like they're safe or have a safe environment.
Yeah, no one wants to work in a place where they're going to be in danger, whether that's an unsafe manufacturing assembly location where it's just not safe from an equipment standpoint, nor do they want to work in a place where they're being threatened by leaders and coworkers.
Well, what are some of the common pitfalls for organizations when they go about developing their workplace violence prevention programs?
One of the common challenges we run into is senior leaders who don't understand the threats that are out there in the workplace. Either they're too removed from it or they excuse the behavior. And I think you really have to explain to them, you can take the compliance route and explain to them, well, the law requires you to do XYZ and you have to have a safe workplace. And that will resonate with some of them, but it's better to do what you were just mentioning, which is taking them through the competitive advantage a safe environment provides to their organization and how that impacts their reputation positively or negatively in the workplace if they don't. But I think that's often one of the biggest challenges is helping them understand there really is an issue around this in most workplaces and that they need to have processes in place to address that.
And do you often find that there's internal, let's say, misalignment among different levels of management about what they should be doing here and that can cause serious problems?
There is misalignment. I always think of it as the strategic disconnect between what leaders think and what actually needs to be done in some cases. The other issue I see that we run into here is that this is never successful without a cross-functional effort. There is a big human aspect to this that falls into the HR world of making sure that the team is taken care of and that the company's interests are protected. But there's also a big role for security here and for a safety or risk management team because of the legal obligations involved. But for security, it's also how do we mitigate this threat, particularly if it is an actual threat of violence where someone's in danger, whether that's It's an outside actor, like a domestic violence situation that could carry over into the workplace, or there's an actual serious threat of violence between two employees, for example. There's a role here for several teams to be involved, and managing that in an effective cross-functional way is not how a lot of companies tend to start to think about this. They think of it as it's an HR problem or it's a security problem. It's really a leadership issue, and you need all of your disciplines at the table in order to navigate that successfully.
Yeah, and it really should permeate the organization, not be siloed where, oh, security's only brought in once it's a problem. No, security should be involved all the time. It's interesting. I was visiting with a customer of ours recently, and we were walking around getting a tour of the facility, and this gentleman's role is to lead security, and he said that he's called the mayor. And I'm like, you mean the sheriff? He's like, oh, no, not the sheriff. That sounds like I'm this guy that comes in when there's a problem. I'm the mayor. Anyone can come to me anytime for anything. And we make sure that things are moving along smoothly all the time. And I like that way of thinking about things. Security is involved all the time, not just when there's a problem.
That's right. I had a similar experience as I was interim chief security officer for an organization for 18 months. They were going through a period of layoffs. And there were a number of issues in the layoffs where people got upset and, you know, would issue threats and what have you. And what I learned early on is that the security team was not involved in the planning for these layoffs. We were coming in after the fact when the threat had happened. And by working with the leadership team to say, look, here's what we really want to do. We want to understand up front what's happening. We want to help you change some of your practices to maybe reduce the strain on the team when they're being let go. And we know that some of these folks are going to be at higher risk of those kind of threats than others. We want to be more directly involved in that. There was some obstacles to that at first, but eventually they saw the value in having our team there from the planning all the way through the end of execution, not because we were trying to be the sheriff, but it allowed us to influence that process and address the risk and the threats up front.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have an example of a company that's been really successful in their overall workplace violence prevention program that you could talk about a little bit? Maybe leave the names out?
So there's a large retailer we worked with several years ago around this very thing. They did not have a formal workplace violence and threat management program. So we helped them from the beginning really establish really what we've just talked through here. We started with centralized reporting, with a policy statement from senior executives. And then we worked through training from the bottom up in terms of understanding what a threat is and how to report it, from the top down on what are the management leadership responsibilities in escalating this process. And then we helped them set up a centralized way of managing these threats. And then over time, they built more local threat management teams that where they really started to distribute and decentralize some of the day-to-day threat management actions and had some centralized reporting so they knew what was going on from a governance perspective. It took them a good 18 months from start to finish to develop and roll out a program, but it's been very successful for them, and they've reduced their number of threats and violent incidents over time.
That's a great story. Like, what's the feedback you heard from them? Or maybe more broadly, what's the most common piece of feedback you hear after helping a company implement or improve their programs like that?
The feedback usually follows a cycle of where at first it's, I can't believe we had so many threats going on. And then as the program takes root and they really start to work through threats and they get better awareness of what's going on, we typically see those numbers go down overall in the organization. So that produces a different type of feedback, which is, well, this is great. We're able to reduce the risk over time in the number of incidents that we are seeing.
Well, switching a bit from the strategic to more the tactical, I understand you've got a pretty unique approach to running crisis tabletop exercises. Can you tell us just a bit about that?
So a lot of the work that we do here at BrightPath involves building and exercising crisis management plans. For some of our clients that have some regulatory obligations where they have to do data breach exercises or cybersecurity exercises, we do a pretty intense multi-day crisis simulation where they're having to work through a scenario in real time. And this is definitely not for an organization that just put in their first crisis management plan and program this year. It's something that you get to over time of growing and maturing your program. But with these clients, we really help them go through a crisis simulation where they're having to deal with things in real time. So in this particular example, we have a client in healthcare technology that has a annual obligation to do a crisis management simulation around a data incident. So over a two-day period, they have to learn about the incident, react in real time, the same way they would get inputs in real life. They're getting text messages, emails, Microsoft Teams messages. They're having to have the actual conference calls. They're having to write the communications. They're having to escalate decisions to executives. The executives have to play and send their direction back down. And they have to continue to work through this in real time over a 48-hour period. It really puts them to the test around, do these processes they've built and practiced in their crisis management plan, do they work? And are they able to do the things in the timeframes that they say that they're able to do? And so they always come out of this with a lot of lessons learned, but it has made them better and better year over year as they work through this. It's a pretty significant time commitment from their leadership team, but they believe it adds value to the organization.
And doing these exercises is like, there's many reasons, but one is it creates muscle memory, and two, it exposes weakness. But it sounds like you say, don't do this until you've spent time maturing your organization, because maybe you just don't know enough yet and you can expose way too many weaknesses and it becomes overwhelming if you do it too early.
Well, I think it almost like, if you're a Star Trek fan like me, it's the Kobayashi Maru exercise. It's the no-win scenario, you know, in Star Trek, where the whole purpose is to see how you handle failure. I don't want them to fail. I want teams to feel confident in their role in crisis management and build that confidence over time in tabletops and more, I think, less complex scenarios until they're ready for something like this. And then you can really start to push the team and have them get prepared in that way.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Well, I know you're also an expert in crisis communications, which is absolutely near and dear to my heart, so I'd be pretty remiss if I didn't ask you about that. But what's your number one tip for improving or perhaps optimizing crisis communication, specifically around workplace violence awareness and prevention?
With crisis communications in this space, I think where this really comes into play is when you've had an incident where the threat became reality, you've had some kind of violent attack. And I think this is where we really put crisis communications folks and leaders to the test about how they can communicate this tragic incident or, you know, loss of life in a way that is empathetic and appropriate to the scenario that they've been in. I think that's a real art to think about and work through. It's an important place where your CEO or your local leader, if it's at a local site, really has to be trained and be ready for that kind of communication with the media. I think folks are expecting to see that in the local community, particularly if you're a large employer.
And it's not always titled. It should speak to the media, right? It's whoever's most prepared for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the example I would have is like in my former life at a retailer, we had some fatalities at local stores sometimes, whether they were workplace violence or it was some other external actor, like a robbery or what have you. The store manager is really the right person to talk to the media in this case. They might need a little bit of training prior to going out there beyond what they would normally get, but it doesn't need to be the corporate CEO from 10 states away. It should be the local face of the business in that case.
Yeah, and to your point, they need a little training. And I think in advance, like, you don't need to give everyone deep training, but at least tell the manager, hey, if something happens, we're going to rely on you because you know the most about what's going on. Yep. Here's what you do and don't do initially. You can buy yourself a little time, come to us, then we'll tell you what to say specifically, but still you're the one that's going to go out and do it.
Yep. And I think just prepping them on the kind of questions that I know the media is going to ask them and helping them think about what those answers are going to be without over-preparing them. Right? I want them to be their authentic selves in that case.
Mm. And then what about communicating with just employees in general during these situations? Do you share everything you can immediately? Like, how do you work through that process as a situation's unfolding?
Well, I think you have to realize it's likely there's some kind of investigation going on. So there may be things you can't say. I think that it is important to make sure that the leadership at that site talks with the local team and lets them know. And then I think if we stick with that example, corporately, I think you have to decide, do you need to communicate this on a broader scale within the organization? In the retail example, when I had fatalities or homicides at stores, we didn't always communicate that like to a broad corporate audience outside of the leaders that really needed to know what had happened because it didn't really raise concerns. But when things happened at our corporate headquarters, of course, we did do that because they're going to see it. in the local news, they're going to know about it from communication with other employees.
And do you find that social media has changed the game here with that, since people can start spreading rumors and it's just so much easier to get messages out there, right or wrong?
Social media has totally changed the game around this. The perfect example, about a decade ago, when I was head of crisis management for a Fortune 50 company, we had an active shooter scare at a headquarters location. And before we could even get our first holding statement out, I mean, it was impossible to avoid the media not knowing what was going on because there were hundreds of police responding to this incident. But before we could even get the first holding statement out, we had employees posting on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook photos of them sheltering in place inside of a corporate building. So you couldn't have done that 20, 30 years ago. And the pace of that has only... Now I think you'd probably get TikTok videos of the same thing.
Yeah.
So it's forced companies to move more quickly. And I think it's forced companies to have to say more earlier in these situations and have a good mechanism for monitoring social media so that they know what is out there.
Well, speaking of change, as we start to wrap up today, how do you see the role of resilience leaders evolving in the future? Like, how do we as professionals in this discipline need to adapt to our organization's growing resilience needs, like in areas like that and others?
I've said for a few years now that I think resilience is the dominant business theme of this decade. I say that because there's such a massive amount of uncertainty in the world today, and it doesn't matter if you're looking at geopolitical disruption to supply chain disruption in the Red Sea right now, to internet lines being cut, to cyber attacks that we're seeing happening right now. And it just goes on and on and on from there everywhere around the world. So I think this is a great time to be a leader in resilience. I think your boards and your C-suite executives have never looked for stronger leadership from our industry and leaders like us than ever before. And it's a great time to seize that opportunity. That's where I think we can play a bigger role in the organization, is making sure we're ready to influence at that level.
Yeah, and to the point you made earlier, things are just moving so much more quickly than they ever did in the past. You used to be able to sit on things for quite some time. So people are like, time will pass. No, now it happens instantly. It spreads around the world in a second. And that's you got to have people that are highly capable of dealing with that.
Yep.
Very good. Well, final question, Kirk or Picard?
Oh, Picard, for sure. For sure. I mean, I'm old enough. I grew up on the original Star Trek, but I think Picard is the better captain. But I'm more of a Benjamin Sisko fan.
Okay, very good. So, well, that could be a whole separate podcast episode.
We can talk Trek.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for being on the show today. I learned a lot. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
To learn more about Brian and his work with BrightPath, click the links in the show notes. For video highlights from today's episode, just search for Alert Media on YouTube. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review the show wherever you get your podcasts. Stay safe out there.
Thank you for listening to the Employee Safety Podcast from Alert Media, the industry's most intuitive emergency communication and threat intelligence solution. To learn more about how to protect your people and business during critical events, visit alertmedia.com. Until next time.